Hey, all you plebs out there, thanks for joining us back at High Hash Rate after this extended hiatus. Had a lot of personal reasons for pressing the pause button on the show. Mainly, it comes down to time commitment. A lot has changed since we recorded this episode that you're about to hear back in early October. Obviously, Trump has become president. Ross Ulbricht is free, thank God. You know the deal. You keep up with current events, right? Anyway, this will be the first of three releases that we wanted to share with you before we went offline. I just want to thank you all for the support that you've given us while we were away. Specifically, I'm looking at you, Boomer, Fundamentals, Dave Bradley, thank you. And there's a ton of others that reached out, so thank you guys. You guys are really the reason why I knew I had to get back on the beat. Anyway, here's the first of three. This is with Tomer Strohlite. Let's roll it.
As you know, we've partnered with Bitbox, makers of the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. It's a secure, open source, Bitcoin-only hardware wallet with the best user experience in the industry. I personally use it to guarantee that I'll always have access to some of my Bitcoin in cold storage whenever I travel. If you want to check out Bitbox O2, you can use the promo code HIGHHASHRATE to get 5% off your purchase or go to bitbox.swiss/HIGHHASHRATE. All one word, no spaces. Check them out.
Ah, screw it. Here we go.
Appreciate as a human being, you've been given a mind that can enjoy things that take a long time. Take your time. I purposely said that slowly, right? Like, you know, take your time. We have all the time in the world. And that's one thing that Bitcoin certainly gives you an appreciation of and gives you the opportunity to do.
Hey, everybody, this is the High Hash Rate Podcast. I'm Mike.
And I'm Dan.
And this podcast is just two plebs getting high and talking about Bitcoin, life, and the absurdity of the fiat world. Our guests don't necessarily get high with us, and you don't have to either.
But it helps. Welcome back to High Hash Rate. Tonight we're here with kind of like one of our white whales who we haven't been able to catch. We've been trying to get him on the show since we started two and a half years ago, but he's finally here. So we're here with Tomer Strohlite. Tomer.
Finally happening.
Welcome to High Hash Rate. Thank you so much for your time and coming on here.
I'm glad to finally be on board.
Hell yeah.
And glad to get me here.
I mean, that is true. We all sort of, I think we all were mingling around, what was it, 2022 Bitcoin conference in Miami?
Yeah.
And we were all just talking about how we need to have this conversation. And since then, you know, all these conversations start to come up. And
yeah, it's going to be a lot more interesting now than it would have been then, that's for sure.
It's a different time. It'd be interesting.
Different insights.
I'd done it then and we're doing it again now, but
yeah, for sure.
This is what it is.
And the listeners know that we are just kind of getting back on hitting our rhythm again. We kind of had like it took a little bit of a break. We were all going through a lot of changes this summer. And Mike moved, So now he's officially, for the first time, he's got his podcast studio.
This is the inaugural.
It's the garage. It's his man cave. It's his garage.
Right. That's cool.
That's the modern man cave, right? The podcast studio.
It's the messy garage. Because of all the move.
That makes a big difference.
You were mentioning that, Tomer, before we got on, was just that you start to accumulate all this stuff and you just end up with trash everywhere.
And you move it with you from house to house when you move, too. Like, you try to get rid of as much as you can. I guess it depends on the personality type, but then you have all these personalities in a household, some of which are real hoarders or clingers, and others want to get rid of stuff. And some stuff just keeps moving with you. I found out that I traumatized my kids when we moved from our last house to this house when we were selling it. I went and bought them all these plushies as they were growing up. And they were like now, they were in their teens. And to make space, to make the house look more presentable, I took a bunch of these plushies and donated them to the Goodwill. And my kids were like, years later, it's like, you traumatized us. You took our toys and got rid of them without letting us know. So I mean, that's their experience, right?
Part of that junk and that clutter is attachments. It's like attachments, right? And like that's a little bit in our culture too, right? Where we've got a lot of baggage, a lot of cultural baggage, political baggage, economic baggage. Their whole finding, everything's got baggage, and it's holding us back, right? Like
I wonder. Yeah. I mean,
is it holding us?
I share that view. Like for me, if you took away all of my possessions and I just basically had the clothes I was wearing, I'm fine. Right. It's like, I don't need any of that stuff. But for other people, their attachment to objects, we've had four dogs, three of which have passed in our had a life. And so two of them are buried because we lost them in the last couple of years. They're buried in our backyard here. And today we laid down a stone that my wife had bought for the one who most recently passed. And there's a real attachment to their physical presence, even though their spiritual presence is no longer attached to their physical bodies. But for the people in my family, that was really touching. Whereas I'm just attached to the memories, to the spiritual thing rather than the physical thing. So different. I'm a very physical person in other regards, but when it comes to property or dead matter, I'm not that attached to it.
What about you, Mike? When you moved, did you find yourself having a hard time saying goodbye to things or getting rid of things that you would make your life easier if you could get rid of, you didn't have to move with it? Or was it easy? Were you purging?
I have 2 points on that. One is the point that Tomer was making made me feel like, you start to accumulate so much shit that the attachments that you, or sorry, the things that you start to attach yourself with, you have to realize like, oh, I don't want to attach myself so much sentiment into this thing, because that's just going to start accumulating. And so what I find is that I'm getting rid of more and more stuff that I used to think was valuable to me, and now it's not. And in addition to that, I start to think that I have to be ruthless with what I'm getting rid of, like, because you know, we can accumulate so much shit. And why are we accumulating so much shit? It just keeps on coming. It's so easy to get products. It's so easy to get things these days.
Yeah. Stuff is always coming in. You know, it's an effort to keep up with how much stuff you have to throw out. How do we get onto this tangent? I guess it has something to do with your basement or your garage setup. Mike, this is my first time on the podcast. Are you guys high right now already, or do you get?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes.
We start off.
Yeah. I don't come in dry, well, man.
I didn't know I was necessarily going to go this direction, but since we started, and it made me think of an interesting point, which is it's hard. You accumulate all this baggage. Maybe some people don't. It just depends on how efficient you are with your shit, how organized you are with your shit. But when you're new to a technology like Bitcoin, the blockchain, and we have all these crazy mechanisms going on in the background, you got UTXOs and all these things that are kind of difficult to understand. But if you're not thoughtful about your management of your resources, it can affect things. So like we've had things like this ordinals problem. We had things like when transaction fees get high. Do you think that as a culture, as a network, that we're kind of going through this relearning the value of some of these smaller mechanisms and relearning the value of UTXOs and being more thoughtful about how we manage our resources?
Well, you know, I guess this is kind of the interesting thing, right? Bitcoin, like your household, where you've got some people who are good at getting rid of shit and others who accumulate it, and you all have to live together. We all got to live together on this one blockchain, right? And it's not just me and my, you know, my kids and my wife and their partners and or you guys. It's like the whole fucking world has to share this one blockchain, and it's a permissionless system, so anyone can take a share in it as long as they're prepared to pay for it and do what they do according to the rules at the time, you know? And so some people, I think, were kind of intentionally showing that they could piss in a corner because they can afford to piss in a corner. That's my interpretation of the ordinals, right? And I think it's an accurate interpretation of some people's attitudes towards it, right? It's like, look, I can inscribe a 4 megabyte really ugly JPEG into your blockchain, and you have no choice but to hold on to it, right? So it's kind of like that forcing your way, making a mess of someone else's, of a common space that you're sharing with someone else. I thought that's pretty loathsome, but it's also part of what we have to accept. I think there were other people who were kind of like, oh, look at this valuable piece of graffiti that I've put on the wall here, or this valuable piece of graffiti that someone told me I own because I've got an ordinal, but everyone else has the same piece of graffiti. So there's just like, there's also a big misunderstanding and a big learning process we're going through. I mean, that's the beauty of Bitcoin is not that some central authority tells you this is how it is. It's like we all learn together, and it's like someone shows that something is possible, and then people are like weighing in on what, just because you can, that doesn't necessarily mean you should. And someone else is saying, well, just because I can, I will. And someone else is saying, well, I think I can make money off of it, or I think there's value, or this or that or the other. So we discover through trial and error together. We live together just like a family. Or a community, right? So it really is a community, but it's not, you know, we can't put rose-colored glasses on. A community contains all sorts, including those who would want to destroy the community for no other reason than nihilism, right? For no other reason than the demonstration that they could. And that's why it's such a rugged, anti-fragile system. It was designed with that view in mind. And I think that's wise, right? Like, you know, when you build something on the expectation that everyone will treat it gently, you build a fragile system. When you build a system with the expectation that the world's most powerful forces are going to attack it and try to destroy it, you build something indestructible.
Totally. Yeah. And it's like sometimes the people think, what can I do as an individual? Because, right, sometimes you feel like this is such a something that's so much bigger than myself, and like,
yeah,
very hard to have individual influence, right? And it's like, what can I do? And it's like, my opinion anyway is to be the best steward of your resources and to show by example, like, that your approach to the way you're using it is the most economical, is the most
right,
you know, it follows,
and to learn from
exactly.
others,
right?
Right,
exactly.
You know, like, you know, to have an open mind to say, okay, well, you know, someone's doing something different. Before I tell them that they're wrong because they're different, evaluate what's the pros and cons. Maybe they're not doing it perfectly right, but maybe they're a step in the right direction, or something else was done, you know, another step, it could be a solution. So I think Bitcoin's always in that evolution of figuring it out. And we're still in really early days. Like, I think there's a lot of people who have to learn about it, a lot of people have to learn how to use it. And then a lot of people who are interested in seeing how can it be better than what it is? And how do I convince enough other people to make it better, or convince other people to work with me in that other way that it might be better? So we go through our episodes for sure.
How have you seen, Tormer, how have you seen how the civilization, like, you like how it's starting?
Sure. Yeah. Start right with civilization.
So how the society has progressed, their adoption of Bitcoin. Have you seen an uptick in your traffic, the people you correspond with? Are there more people coming in? Are you getting new ideas, or are we just doing the same old?
Oh, that's
you know, one.
If I understand the thing. Question, I mean, there's like. If I take 2 points, the present and when I first got into Bitcoin, right? So those are 2 points that are 11 or 12 years apart now. And I was one of the first people, certainly in my circle. I heard of Bitcoin from one other person who I was tangentially connected to me and nobody else had at the time. So I was like the first person in my circle to start talking about Bitcoin. And I, of course, was falling deep, deep, deep down the rabbit hole. So I wasn't just like, hey, have you heard of this new Batman movie? I hear it's pretty good. And then everyone hears about it and everyone agrees it's pretty good. It was like, no, I haven't heard of that thing and it doesn't make any sense. And it's only because I have such respect for you, Tomer, that you went through so many things and the disruptive technologies that you explored before that I'm even paying any attention to you, because this idea sounds like the craziest one you've ever come up with. And I just want to remind you, you had some crazy ideas that didn't work out. So like that was the kind of conversation that I would have been having 11 years ago with a lot of people. And I was super excited. And I'm like, this is the next internet. And it's even bigger. Like that's where I was coming from. And they were, well, but maybe it isn't. And maybe there'll be a lot of, you know, competitors and this and that and the other. So that was the take of a lot of people back then. I think what's interesting now is, of course, every single person has heard of Bitcoin, not just from me. They probably, in my circles, have heard more about it from me than from others, but all, to the point of exhaustion rather than to the point of entertainment. But the fact that everybody's heard of it anchors that point. There's like, you said something big was coming and something kind of big looks like it's come. Maybe it's over. Maybe it's not. Maybe there's a competitor. Maybe the government is going to fight it hard. Maybe I think that I don't think a lot of people give it nearly as much thought as people like us do, right? Like we're obsessed with Bitcoin. They're like, oh, is it really, is the narrative over? Like I'm pleased, you said it would survive. It definitely survived. It's been around for 12 years. You said governments would attack it. They did. Did you see? You said that it wouldn't, the government attacks wouldn't succeed. You were right. But where is it going now? It feels like, and again, it's different people that I speak to in different contexts. So, and I don't speak to that many people, but I would say like that, there's a growing respect for Bitcoin, but not to the same degree that I think it's going to be transformative still. So there's people saying, you know what, 60,000 a coin, 70,000 a coin. I get that now. I never got it when it was $650 a coin, but now that it's 100 times that, I actually do get it. It's more valuable, and maybe it's still got a runway to go. Maybe it's kind of plateaued. Maybe it'll settle down. So, but when I share like the movies that I made with them or the deep spiritual essays on Bitcoin, that's like for some of them, they're like, I don't see that. Some of them are too polite to say that, but I know that that's what they're saying. Others are like, wow, like that may be true. And I don't know how to figure out if it's true or not. So I'm like, I'm curious and I'm watching from the sidelines. And maybe you've gone crazy, Tomer, or maybe you've discovered that there's something really, significant here on a higher level than just money, than just wealth. Because the reality is a lot of my friends from the last 20 years of my life are career-related friends. So there's money's like always been involved. Like we've tried to make money together, or we've worked together, and one of us has had to deal with the other's compensation packages. So money is woven into the fabric of a lot of these relationships. When I think about the friendships that I've had for 40 years, and many of those really took a long hibernation during COVID, like a lot of that stuff separated. But as I start to rebuild those things, there's not that much talk about Bitcoin. Like I tell them, I made my money in it or something, or I was working in it for the last few years. But that's really it. And I'm not trying to force them to think about it. For many of them, it's too late, or it's not, right? It's not of interest to them. So I just leave it be. I don't even know what question you asked and what question I was answering. I was just like fucking reminiscing there.
I don't even know what question I was looking at.
Yeah. Well, okay. The next three of us.
That's a good point. I think that you kind of made a point there where you're talking about a lot of the people that you have relationships with are from professional context and where money is woven in and out of everything. And then there's a lot of relationships that you have where money is not directly woven in and out of everything. But, especially when it comes to families and closer relationships, the money is really kind of woven in and out of everything, but just not directly. And not everybody appreciates the consequences or like some of the influences that it has. But there's a lot of value or a lot of selling points or just a lot of beauty about what Bitcoin solves that also is not directly tied to money, that you can kind of, at least in my experience, try to use that, those angles and those stories to like kind of help them understand what you see and that it's not just financials or economics, even though, at the end of the day, it really is. It's just a different way of being presented.
Hmm. Yeah.
It's October 9th. So yesterday was the big HBO documentary about Bitcoin and the identity of Satoshi.
I did,
right?
Didn't secretly want to get into this.
Obviously, it got some attention, but
it was big on the timeline, right? Sure, exactly. But did you see that? And I just wanted to know what your reaction was
I didn't watch it. I don't have HBO, and I'm not getting it for the sake of that. When Curb Your Enthusiasm was on, that was a singular reason to pay for HBO, but some clown speculating over who Satoshi is not a reason for me to reactivate it. It feels a lot like Peter Todd's better able to defend himself than Dorian Nakamoto was. Like that, you know, the Dorian Nakamoto unveiling by the media was a total hit upside the head. Like, it's like you're walking down the street and someone pies you in the face. So like, hits you with a pie. You had no idea it was coming. And then they accuse you of something that you've never even heard of. Right. And that was Dorian Nakamoto with Bitcoin. It was like, you are Satoshi Nakamoto because that's your name. And you invented Bitcoin. what? Who? And the reporter was so arrogant. Like, if you were around in those days, she was like, oh, come on, don't play dumb with me. Like, she was the total background. And she was so hubristic. It's like, his name is clearly Satoshi Nakamoto. Therefore, he must clearly be the Satoshi Nakamoto. It was stupidity on such levels. And then we went through the whole Craig Wright thing where we had someone who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto trying to claim to be Satoshi Nakamoto on the flimsiest of evidence, and not just flimsy evidence circumstantial to begin with, like obviously falsified evidence and not cryptographically verified evidence, and in the face of cryptographically verified evidence, because there was also someone who signed 50 blocks that Craig Wright claimed were his, saying that Craig Wright is a liar and a fraud. So it was like, that was a circus, and it still lasted for years. And now we've got, on the basis of very flimsy evidence, like you made a post and you, like this guy accusing or alleging that Peter Todd is Satoshi. And I think this one will be forgotten really, really quickly. Like, people are having a little bit of fun with it on the day after, but I'd be surprised if people are still talking about it even a month from now. Like, we will have moved on. There's not enough credibility there. Nobody gives a fuck.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't know if Mike, if you saw it, but if you haven't seen it, I would just say the conclusions that they come to are silly and they're a dime. Everybody's got their own theory. It's no different than a single pleb posting like, this is who I think Satoshi is. But the rest of the documentary about Bitcoin itself was really well done.
Well, good.
And I think a lot of people who, if they do watch it, I think, the documentary maker did it justice. It was a good representation of Bitcoin.
Okay, but yeah. 2 hours is a long time for a documentary.
For sure.
In this day and age, 40 minutes is a long time, right? Like 30 minutes is a long time. So to string something out for that long, and a lot of these documentaries, I personally am a little tired of them because they are just interviews, like this podcast, sorry to say. Right, it's like it's people talking on camera, and weave a narrative, weave a story, write a script and get actors to concretize it and perform it. There's something to be said for the art of storytelling, and while there's a role for documentaries, I think that they're too. There's too many of them, and they're too stylistically similar. Right, they're just like talking head interviews, and by and large, if it's the same topic, it's of the same people being asked the same questions over and over again. And listen, there's new audiences to it, and that's fair. But if I'm expected to watch the same thing, the same movie over and over again with different titles, I'm just not able to bring myself to do it.
Have you seen the opposite of that? Have you worked on a project like that, or have you seen the opposite of that kind of?
Well, in the few movies that I've made, I've tried to make them short, and I've tried to make them have a narrative. And so, like, that to me was what The Legendary Treasure of Satoshi Nakamoto was. I wish I had made it shorter. It's 38 minutes, but it's only 38 minutes long, and I'm really happy with Bitcoin as generational wealth. Like, there's a story arc through that, and it was original enough that, like, people were so confused about what genre that was. It was like, was that a documentary? Because if it was, how dare you, Tomer? Because documentaries don't speculate on what goes on in the future, and you predicted exactly what the future would be. So I'm like, okay, it wasn't a documentary. It was sci-fi. And they're like, but the stuff you said about in the past was all true. Okay, so it was like 7 minutes of documentary and 7 minutes of sci-fi. Are you happy with that? And they still, the people who were unhappy were just going to be unhappy.
Oh, yeah. It's a no-win situation if you're reflecting on your a perspective of something that happened in the past, people are going to be pissed if it doesn't align with theirs. And if you're speculating or sharing your perspective on what the future will look like, no. Yeah.
I guess my reaction to those, and this is the vast minority, right? Like the number of 8 comments were like, you know, 3% of the comments for both of these films were like people not liking them. And it could be fun to go into the people who didn't like them, but the overwhelming majority of the response I got is like, this is the best thing I've ever seen in Bitcoin. Made me cry. I shared it with friends, you know? So it was like that. And that's what I really wanted to do, I think, in my heart with these things, was like, particularly the first one, because it was my first go at it, the Bitcoin is generational wealth. It was just like to take the hope and love and passion of what Bitcoin could represent and show people not only that it's important, that that there's no substitute for it, that we're losing those values and that this thing could replace them, and what a wonderful world it would be. And now you have to go and learn why that might be and see if you agree. Because I didn't give all the, in 15 minutes, I didn't give all the reasons why it is true. And we debated after the movie came out, Matt Hornick and Adam Hurley and myself, we were the 3 people who worked on putting it together. We debated creating a series like, okay, why are the predictions that we made in Bitcoin as generational wealth going to come true? And what does the world look like in more detail with better housing, with better education, with better food, with better healthcare, with better art? Why does it all come together? We never got around to that. And maybe that's a good thing. I mean, I saw that movie few months ago again, and I was shocked at how well it held up in the intervening years, because it was focused on the 2021 crisis, right? That was the center point where we shifted, like we worked up to the present, and then we worked all over to the future, took a leap into the future, and there was a lot of chaos in the world in 2021, and there's just as much today.
How did you go about getting there with that script? How did that whole project come to be? Because amazing.
I really felt the universe was pushing me in that direction. I was, I had started writing about Bitcoin, you know, not with a job to write about Bitcoin, but just because I didn't have another job and I really loved Bitcoin and I'd been in it for a bunch of years. And so I was writing all over the place. I was writing all sorts of things that moved me. And one of the things that moved me, even though I didn't go to Bitcoin 2021 in Miami, was the story of Fractal Encrypt's artwork that he created there. He created a full node sculpture. And for the first time, instead of using wood, he used glass. So it was a mirror. And so I wrote a piece about how NFTs are bogus and how real art, physical art is real, and how his piece in particular, different people would see different things in it because it was a mirror. Like what would a Bitcoiner see in it? What would a no-coiner see it looking in it? What would a shitcoiner see looking in the mirror? And it was, you know, it was one of these vibrant essays, and Fractal Encrypt really liked it. And the person who bought it really liked it. Louis Liu, who is a Bitcoin venture capitalist out of Taiwan, he paid a lot of money for it at the time. I don't even want to say just how much it was, but it was 6 figures. And he reached out to me and he said he really liked the writing that I did on the artwork that he bought. And he wanted me to write a piece called Bitcoin is Generational Wealth. And I really struggled. And he gave me a quick explanation as to why. He said, you know, his family had generational wealth and it was seized from them during the Communist Revolution. They had to flee to what is now Taiwan. And a lot of their fortune was taken from them. And so they've had to rebuild it. And that's why he's a big believer in Bitcoin, because he could take it with him in the event of something like that. And he wanted me to write about Bitcoin being generational wealth. And that was the entire framework of it. And I struggled with the essay because I was like, well, Bitcoin is, at the time, Bitcoin was like 13 years old, 12 years old. I mean, like, it hasn't even been around for a whole generation, let alone for multiple generations. How could I write about this? And he kept pressing me, and you know, I was really struggling with the topic. I dragged my heels for at least a month, maybe 2, and then I was in the shower one morning, and the shower thought came to me, because I think I'd also spoken to my mother-in-law, whose family lost everything in 1948, and it was like these two connections to 1948 from Europe and from China. Maybe if I start in the past and I talk about what's happened to generational wealth, then I can also project into the future. And so, and I like that gimmick of the year is, so I start with the year is 1948, and I just let the writing flow through me. And I ended up writing the essay in one or two seatings. And then I this is relevant to this group. I was doing a series of psychedelic therapy sessions at the time, like guided psychedelic therapy. And so I had a session shortly after I finished writing it. And when I was coming down from the session, I read the essay to the guide. And as I was reading it, I'm like, this isn't an essay. This is a movie. I wonder if I can reach out to Lewis and ask him if he'll put up the money to make a movie out of it. I think he was planning on paying me to write the essay, but I never asked for anything to write it. And so I asked Lewis if I could make it. I had actually just met Matt Hordich, the to-be director of this thing, but unknown at the time, like a couple of weeks earlier at a Toronto Bitcoin meetup, and he wanted to work on something. And he showed me some of his work, and I was like, oh, this is perfect. He's really able to take a lot of stock footage and B-roll and music and put it together with narration to make beautiful videos. So I talked to him about it, and he was really excited about it. We got together, we edited the article to make it shorter so that it would be only a 15-minute movie and not like a 25-minute movie, and did a quick rough recording in his apartment. And then the next, like 2 weeks later at the next Bitcoin meetup, Adam Hurley shows up at the very end of it and says, oh, I'm an editor. And like Matt had just literally said, I need an editor because I can direct this, but I don't have the time to edit it. And an editor showed, a Bitcoin editor showed up. So it was like the universe gave me the topic. I didn't come up with it. The universe introduced me to Matt. The universe introduced me to Adam. And then we worked on it together, and we went into the recording studio, and I did a couple of dry reads of the article. And then Matt said, put on the headphones and listen to the music. And the edibles kicked in at the same time as well. And what suddenly I realized, I have a narrator's voice. I have a passion for reading. I have a really, and I think everyone in the room, including the non-Bitcoiner people who owned the studio, were like, wow, this is a powerful script being powerfully read with powerful music. And I think we all knew something special was going to happen there. And lo and behold, like a few weeks later, we shared the rough cut, the early rough cut of it at the Bitcoin meetup again. It was outdoors. It was like early November. So it was this time of year. Now is October, but close enough. And people were crying, right? Like one guy put his arm around me and said, oh my God, I'm crying my eyes out. And so I shared it with Michael Saylor and Corey Clipstead. And they were like, dude, yeah, we'd love to put our names behind it and put our force behind it. And so even just the credibility of saying presented by Swan and MicroStrategy and Mimesis was Lewis Liu's cap, and Bitcoin Magazine at the time also threw their weight behind it. So it was really, you know, like you talk about everyone just give you giving and everyone else giving. That was really what the spirit of Bitcoin was in 2021, right? Like it was so much excitement and so much creativity and so much givingness. It's that warmth has kind of come off right now, right? Like right now, I think Bitcoin's very much about Wall Street's in, and we got to make sure that they don't fuck it up, and you know, and the price is going to go to the moon, and nation state adoption, and all this kind of stuff. But like, and we're serious about it. But we were like in disbelief about it back in 2021. In 2021, it's like, did a nation state really just fucking say that they were going to make Bitcoin legal tender? Like, what is this El Salvador thing? And did, you know, is there really a company that's buying a Bitcoin by the hundreds of millions of dollars? Like, what's going on here? So we were taken aback back then, and now we're like leaning in and trying to control the situation. And maybe the lesson is just sit back and surf the universe, and let its waves flow. Like, don't try to make waves. Don't try to control the weather. Just go with it.
Bitcoin is generational wealth. It really impacted me when I saw it. And I saw it when it was, you know, very early on when it was first released. And what I think I took away from it, what I appreciated most, was the way you told the story, in such that it wasn't just about bringing your money with you, your generational wealth with your money. It was about preserving and being able to bring your culture and the essence of who you were and your family and your traditions, and that those wouldn't be lost. Just you didn't just have to go to the future with your money, but you could also go with who you were. You could bring yourself to the future, right? And I think that that is still being absorbed, because I think people have still not gotten that concept, but some have, like El Salvador and some of these, like Bhutan. It's like our culture doesn't have to dissolve. We can preserve it and take it to the future. We don't just have to be dust in the wind in the dustbin of history.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the sound money. The hard money allows you to build things for generations. And so it's not a sellout. It's in fact, you know, it's a sell in, it's a buy in, and you can get people to understand what the value is, because it's a generational value. Anything that doesn't last a generation, by definition, doesn't last for multiple generations. It's just like something that pops up and disappears. But the things that really are built to last, and that for me is like, I don't think humanity has ever built anything to last as long as Bitcoin. And again, that's presumptuous. Like, Bitcoin's only been around for 15 years. The pyramids have been around for 5,000. How do you know? Well, they're worn down. Bitcoin is a perfect, like indestructible, immalleable construction that keeps growing in an indestructible manner. And when you realize and understand how the nature, like it exists indestructibly in cyberspace. It exists indestructibly, unalterably as a data structure, but that's still a man-made structure. And it's a man-made structure that cannot be destroyed or altered or damaged or dented. And when you start to appreciate why and how that is, you get fucking blown away. And then you enter into some other cosmic realm. Like it hits everybody differently, right? It's like acid or mushrooms. It's like you don't know what you're in for, but you know you're in for something big. And when you take the Bitcoin pill to understand like how the system works, how blocks are built, what energy goes in, why it's immalleable, why nobody can reorganize, delete, alter any of the past records, and you understand the mathematics behind it, you have a trippy experience. And it touches every part of your being. It touches every part of your psyche, every part of your brain. It's like you don't fall down the rabbit hole. Bitcoin, like, it spreads out throughout your brain and it affects every avenue of your consciousness. And I think that is, that's, again, indescribable with precise language, right? It's like you can write many different things. You can say many different things about it. I've tried to say many different things about it in my writing, but it's deeply personal for everybody because everyone's got a unique brain and Bitcoin touches all those different parts and connects them in different ways. I think that's why some people have written Bitcoin is like a psychedelic. You know, like I've seen recent articles that have done fMRIs of people's brains when they take mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, and it's like the whole thing lights up, right? Like your brain is normally little bits and pieces are lit up at a time, but everything lights up all at once. And I think this is a similar phenomenon when Bitcoin like permeates and says, oh, here's something that we've built that's indestructible. It also acts as money. It acts as a record of history. It preserves rights and freedoms and liberties. And like, so it's like, well, hold on, every part of my brain, and I need math to understand it. So it's like, it's integrating every single discipline you've ever been taught or been curious about, even and not even been formally taught, like money, for example. And so, boom, it just blows your mind completely, like a psychedelic experience does.
Yes.
Maybe at a different pace.
Right. And it gives you the opportunity to change your behavior, and so that you are expressing yourself. And if you express yourself at the fullest extent possible and in a very positive and productive way, whether somebody 2,000 years from now can download Bitcoin, whatever it is in 2,000 years, and look at a node and see your transactions, they can see off-chain the impact you left behind,
legacy,
the architecture you built,
right?
the art
the legacy
that you
of
created.
Every move that you made on-chain is there forever, right? So you do something embarrassing, it's there for generations from now to laugh at you. You do something proudful, it's there for generations. You do something that's inconsequential, it'll be ignored by generations there. But, it, you know, there will be there will be archaeologists who study the blockchain. There already are, right? Like if you guys know Wicked, if you've ever had him, Wicked Smart Bitcoin on your show, like he does these great videos of going through the history of the blockchain. He's done one recently with the Satoshi pattern. He did one with the hash rate, like the hash rate difficulty and the actual hashes that have been found, the hash values that have been found to for each block. And like they're fascinating bits of history. And when he did the looking at the Satoshi pattern recently, he came back and he's like, whoa, I think I may have spotted like a couple of times when Satoshi reorged the blockchain and nobody paid attention because nobody was mining it at the time. And we'll never know for certain, but I think different historians and archaeologists of the Bitcoin blockchain will take a look. Hey guys, can we take just 1 minute break? I just need to go to the washroom. I'll come back.
Sure.
Let me just mute.
I think the acid's kicking in.
Oh, man.
He's great.
Yeah. I mean, Tomer's a mad scientist in this space, man.
Oh, yeah.
He has all sorts of interesting shit that he...
It's easy to take that for granted just when you're like, oh, yeah, it's Tomer. I used to work with him.
Well, you always know that, you know, this goes for a lot of people in the space, too. You always know that there's regular people behind the celebrity of Bitcoin, right? But it's hard to get past that fucking wall or that barrier, because you understand there is a barrier to entry to getting well known in this space. So you have to I think about this kind of stuff all the time.
You have to cultivate.
You have to be honest.
You have to cultivate your brand and your image.
And that's true. But you have to speak well and you have to be able to say the things that you want to say and stand behind them.
Right.
That's a difficult thing to do.
That was why I didn't want to start this. That's what was my journey, was trying to get to the point where it's like, with the stuff I'm saying, do I want to stand behind this?
You really grasp on, my friend.
Yeah. Sorry about that, guys.
No problem.
All good. All good.
Pick up where we left off.
Yeah.
I can't even remember where we were.
I do. I just wanted to ask, something that kind of a theme that came up as we're talking was that we're so close to this, and we've been following this and been passionately involved and interested in this for years. Within your situation, more than a decade, and so we're so close to this. So it's very difficult to be impressed, or sometimes it can be very difficult to be like, what makes me want to read this or watch this documentary, et cetera. So what kind of ideas or what kind of media or what kind of stuff interests you now? Like, what catches your attention and makes you want to spend the time and effort to dig deeper? Because there's just so much nonsense to dig through, it seems like.
Yeah. It's dialogues with other people that trigger further curiosities for me. I was talking on the phone with Eric Kaysen the other day, and, I thought, I've finished my political inquiry journey into Bitcoin. It's radicalized me. But my views have settled, and he was talking a lot of philosophical things and their implications, and I realized, oh my God, we're still, I go around saying we're still so early, and I say somewhat flippantly, like I realized, oh my God, we are still so early, and there's still so much work to do, and there's so many ideas to synthesize, integrate, discuss, elaborate upon, learn from, that I know, as much as I think I know, I actually know just a tiny little sliver, and that's humbling and inspiring at the same time. So I think that for me is like finding other intellectuals in the space who are studying things that challenge my beliefs about what's true about Bitcoin or what the path it's going to take is and why it needs to take a certain path or doesn't need to, but might, or certainly won't take a certain path. I think those are really interesting things for me to weigh in on, especially the ones where, where I've got a keen curiosity, because if you don't have the motivation to learn something, then you just don't learn it. At least that's the case. That's the case for me. And then when you have the motivations, like, what can you actually take away from it? What are your goals? And for me, a big part of getting into writing was, well, I'm very motivated to understand Bitcoin, and I'm also very motivated to share my understanding of Bitcoin. And it's one thing to understand it. It's another thing to take that understanding and transform it into something that will help people who are not as learned in some topics, or are not as curious, or not as prepared to work as hard, that you can simplify it for them or present it for them in a way that you had to figure out the recipe from scratch by lots of experimentation, lots of time spent, but you can now present them with a finished recipe for, well, here's why Bitcoin takes time and energy to produce, synthesized into a clear idea. Here's why Bitcoin is stable, all these kinds of things.
In a very lovely story-like format, you were able to deliver that.
Yeah, so like I think that for me has been a really big motivator. I do think for most of my, like all of the learning that I gathered up, that whole basket of stuff that I foraged for in my first dozen years in Bitcoin, I think I've written most of that up. Like I don't have a lot of ideas about Bitcoin that I haven't written essays about or tried to make movies about. And so it's like, okay, now it's time to go back out into the forest and forage for more ideas. And so I think that's where I'm at right now. And it takes time. And if there's one thing Bitcoin has allegedly taught me, it's to have a low time preference. But I've become spoiled and expectant that Bitcoin's going to deliver quick things for me. And, you know, maybe my next great essay is 12 more years away, because that's how much time I have to spend studying Bitcoin to find the next great insight to actually write the next great essay. Because like, I don't have the next great essay like that I'm working on. I have some ideas that I've started writing essays on and I haven't even bothered to finish them because I'm like, this isn't revealing enough about unknown stuff that it's worth putting out. You know, it's like, I can say this in a tweet. I don't need to write a whole essay. I don't need to make a whole movie. So that for me is kind of like this next big part of the journey. It's okay, well, where are you focusing your learning? Is it again in this very diverse set of disciplines and trying to find out how they fit together in ways that you never thought were, in ways you were never able to fit them together before, but Bitcoin brings that together? Is it, well, there's a really big societal, political, philosophical shift taking place, and here's how Bitcoin influences and fits into it. And maybe here's a bunch of things that don't really appear to have anything to do with Bitcoin at all. You know, like I really feel that it's been such a centerpiece of my focus and that I've almost forced everything into Bitcoin. It's like, oh, look, you know, McDonald's has a new sandwich out. How does this affect Bitcoin? Or what does Bitcoin teach us about this? And it's like, well, you know, maybe you're now just bending things too far and they're starting to break, or they're, you know, you're not really getting the connection. And it's fine, right? Like not every last point has to be connected immediately with knowledge into Bitcoin. But I do think, you know, from the few really interesting conversations I've had lately, it's like the spiritual thing is really big and important. And I don't just mean spiritual in like this mystical or religious way. I mean like the non-physical components of it, the values that that make us human, that are of the spirit, right, of our soul. So, you know, whether you take a religious or not view of it, you have to admit that the intangible exists and is real. Just because you can't touch language, it still exists, right? You can't dispute its existence, and you can't dispute our emotions exist. Even if you're a determinist, you say, okay, well, they're determined by chemicals and neurons and electrical firings and physical manifestation. It's like, well, but they're non-physical. And I think that this for me is where, at least for me, and I know many others, Bitcoin's been the wedge, the thin edge of the wedge that gets you into these questions of the spirit and of society and of politics and of purpose and meaning and all. And once you start going down that road, it becomes a very curious road. And it's been a very frustrating road for philosophers for 3,000 years, like, you know, or like at least since the Socrates, right? Since that, since the fathers of modern Western philosophy have been struggling to get satisfactory answers. And just every time you think you've got a satisfactory answer, somebody demonstrates some flaw in it. And, you know, and then they come forward with their theory and they just keep knocking one another over. So, like, you know, I think there's, we haven't been given a full, comprehensive, integrated philosophy of the world and of humanity and of politics and epistemology and metaphysics, and they all fly about everywhere. And we've had some pretty impressive people come through the history books as philosophers or scientists or business people, conquerors, emperors, like all these sorts of people living out and formulating different ideas. And we now have a really different idea that's playing out, and the people are forming things around, right? You've got Bukele on the one hand doing this, you've got people who are running exchanges on the other, you've got open source developers, you've got small movements, big movements. We don't know how it's going to play out. We just know what they're working with and many of its properties, and even some of those might surprise us, both favorably and unfavorably, when they're put to the test.
Yeah, yeah. It's one perspective on a very condensed version of it anyways, of, you know, the past few hundred years. It was like the Renaissance kind of challenged our ideas of what is. And then we kind of went into this epistemic age where we had to relearn, like, what is knowledge and how can we know something is true? And it feels like, and we've talked about this on the show before, that it feels like Bitcoin is part of that process of,
yes,
of a renaissance, that this information technology age that we're going through is kind of like a renaissance, yeah, and we have to go through these philosophical, yeah,
Bitcoin
struggles.
It is a moment in human history where something has been assembled that's going to last for the ages that was unimaginable before it was assembled, right? It's a shift. It's a 0-to-1 moment, or whatever you want to call these things. It's a breakthrough. And all sorts of ideas are coalescing around this breakthrough. And for me personally, I think this is a big thing to say, but I think it represents the new political system of the world that, you know, like Karl Marx came up with communism, Satoshi came up with Bitcoinism. He came up with Bitcoin, and it's a system that does, unlike communism, that does work in practice. In fact, it only works in practice. There's no theoretical, like, there was a 3-month period between Bitcoin being a theory and Bitcoin being a practice. And, you know, the white paper to the Genesis block. And after that, like, the things were, and the white paper didn't really matter nearly as much as what the actual code did do. It maybe served as a guide. And so for some people, it served as too much of a guide because it became obsessed with certain clauses of it over the big picture view of it, but that's to be expected with any kind of big thing. And we can kind of laugh at it because we've been a part of it and we've grown with it. And look at us, we're just ordinary schlubs with messy hair sitting in our garages, you know. But look, Steve Jobs was just a guy with messy hair sitting in his garage, and Martin Luther was probably a guy with messy hair sitting in, you know,
Elon lives in a storage container.
Yeah. Like, history isn't about where you make, it's not about how fancy your bathroom it was. It's about how committed you were and how important the idea was. And like the momentum of history, the acceleration of it, both, it's become terrifying, right? It's like, we don't die in the world we're born in. The world changes completely around us more than once, right? Like, for me,
does our body. Every molecule in our body is different.
Yeah, so so the whole ship of Theseus thing, are we still who we are? That's like, yes, we are, right? So who cares about getting into too philosophical discussion, but like, are we able to cope with the level of change that we actually see in the outside world around us, which is accelerating so rapidly? You know, I used to lament, because I got into digital media just when the internet was becoming hot, that for many of us, we didn't get a full career out of this industry. Right? Like, it changed so much so rapidly that you became obsoleted every 5-10 years, and it was hard to remain relevant. You kind of got old. The young people, what are they Snapchatting with one? Like, what the? Well, they've turned their phone side vertical all of a sudden. Like, aren't screens supposed to be wide and landscape format? And now that everything's, and the videos are all different. How can you watch? And now it's like all moved on to artificial intelligence and writing prompts, and it just moves so fast. Can we keep up with the pace of change, or will we be the things that slow it down because we can't keep up with the rate of change that we're able to produce, or will something else take over for us? It's very hard to know. And I think that that's where, like, you're on this spaceship, it's called Planet Earth, and it's just hurtling through space, and it feels like everything's getting faster and faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. And at some point you're like, this is terrifying. Like, I just can't keep up with the pace of things. And I think that our civilization, our society is kind of feeling that. It's like, this thing is spinning out of control. Everything is going way too fast. Nobody knows what to do about it, right? Like, there's people who are trying to stay at the helm and say, don't worry, I've got this. And it's like, you're not actually in charge, right? Like, who's actually in charge of you? And the people in charge are like, we don't have a fucking clue what we're actually doing. We just think if you give us more control, that we can somehow put the brakes on things, but they can't. The whole, you know, the genie is out of the bottle. Civilization is careening forward. And in some degree, all we can do is hold on and hope for the very best. There's some things we can do that make some things better. I think that's what a lot of Bitcoiners are trying to do, is to say, there's a way to manage chaos through chaos and decentralization, rather than this failing attempt to try to take control of everything and to use the technology to manage and monitor every last thing. It's like, no, go with the flow. We've got to go with the flow. And those of us who go with the flow will, some will get crushed on the shores, but many of them will survive. Whereas those who resist the flow are certain to get destroyed, right? Just can't. The sheer power of civilizational progress is like the power of a hurricane. And, you know, you don't just stand in the face of a tidal wave and hold your hands up and say, I'm going to resist this thing. You surf it and you try to survive it.
You say fight chaos with chaos. It's like fight entropy with entropy.
Yeah. And do you know what? Don't fight it. Like, go with it, right?
Yeah,
like,
there you go.
Don't try to defeat the indefeatable. If you can't beat it, join it. And I, like, you know, we were talking about Bitcoin's generational wealth that day when we were showing it, the pre-screening at the it wasn't finished yet. It was an early rough cut. When we were showing it at the Toronto meetup and we were outdoors and there was a projector and the audio wasn't working, and Matt was trying to get the editors or the sound guys to send him a new version of the file so he could play it. And we'd gotten a little high in waiting for it. And I just sat on the floor and on the brick floor over there. And I was like, I'm just riding whatever happens, right? Like, there's nothing I can do here at this point. I can't micromanage this. I can't get angry at anybody for anything. Like, if it plays, it plays. If it doesn't, okay, then it doesn't. It'll be disappointing, but, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. And it ended up being like one of the best nights of my whole life, for the reason that I just surrendered and let go and surfed reality as it was coming at me. I think there's a lot to be said for that. Like, go, you know, when you see the wave, grab your surfboard and ride it, rather than cower in terror. Or try to stop the wave. Like, you're not doing either, you know, you're not getting much of a joy if you cower in terror, and you're getting smacked in the face if you try to stop the wave. But if you grab the surfboard and ride it, it could be a whole lot of fun. And knowing what your waves are to ride in this world is probably the biggest magic to happiness, if you can figure it out.
Were you always a rider tower?
No. Not at all. Like, wow. That was a surfboard that I grabbed through this psychedelic journey that I went on when I'd always written. You know, I actually remember my bosses used to say, oh my God, like, if when you take Tomer on as an employee, get ready to read a ton, because he writes these long emails. And when Blackberries were out, I could type and drive Like I could type 60 words a minute while driving because you don't have to look down. There was a tactile thing. There was no driver distraction. So I was like writing essays. I don't know if they actually read them, but they would receive them. And so I sharpened my writing skill without ever being published writer and without ever really thinking of myself as a writer. But then when I went through the psychedelic treatment and I had started writing a couple of essays on Bitcoin, I was like reading them and I was like, wow, it's dense what I put in here. Like I'm really, really able to distill a lot of information into a very few words without losing the meaning of the idea. And that's a talent that I have that I want to take advantage of. And that's where the Why Bitcoin series came from. It was like, write a whole bunch of essays that are only 2 minutes to 3 minutes long to read that offer insights that are accessible to everybody, but even insightful to people who've been in Bitcoin for a long time, and have the word "why" in Bitcoin in each title. And when that started to come to me, it came to me really fast. And I was able to expectorate, you know, to exude a lot of essays in a very short period of time that had all of these ideas about how Bitcoin was so different from everything else that came before it. Almost fun.
Yeah, it's... part of the reason I'm, you know, an advocate of this, you know, small blockers on the small blocker side is because I haven't seen enough evidence that we can press the signal and get more value into a smaller space yet. And it's just like you said, it's like getting better at condensing the message to a smaller and smaller and still get the point across.
Society, right? Like society isn't sitting back and saying, give me a 13-hour documentary. They're saying... condense everything as much as you can. I don't have patience. I don't have time. People aren't even playing, you know, they only
That's why they like TikTok, you know?
They like TikTok, right? It's like, we can observe this and there's also time to break free from it. It's like, appreciate as a human being, you've been given a mind that can enjoy things that take a long time. Take your time. I purposely said that slowly, right? Like, you know, take your time. We have all the time in the world. And that's one thing that Bitcoin certainly gives you an appreciation of and gives you the opportunity to do. But I don't want to force Bitcoin into this. I'm just saying, like, when you find something that you love, do it and take your time doing it. Like, what's your rush? If it's something that you love to do, spend time in it. Don't finish it quickly so that then you can move on to something you don't love. Right, just go and be with who you love. Do what you love. Right?
Love.
Find what you love. Seek out what you love, and spend time doing that.
Well, my final question for you tonight, Tomer, is something it seems like you've already answered here in the past, you know, hour long conversation, which is like I was going to ask, like, what do you want to work on next, and what do you want to do next? But it sounds like you would say you're taking your time, going with the flow, and exploring the spiritual side more.
For sure. And at this and at the same time, taking my time and spending time with my friends and my family, the people I really love, and not being apologetic about it. Like, so much of my fiat career, it was like, well, you owe time to the corporation. You have to keep making money. You can't, are you taking care of your family if you're being with them instead of making money for them? That was a very difficult and subconscious tug of war battle that took place inside of me during those years. And now I'm like, no, if I'm going to be there with my wife, I'm going to be there for her, not thinking about how I'm going to make my next, you know, few dollars at it or lots of dollars. I need to take my time and appreciate it, because you're getting older, Tomer, right? Like, you ain't getting no younger. So take your time doing the thing. That doesn't mean a rush. It means use your time wisely. Use it for the things you really value.
Man, that was fantastic. Thank you, Tomer, very much.
Yeah, Tomer. Before we cut, is there anything that, any project or anything you're currently working on that you'd like to highlight?
No, nothing. I'm telling everybody who's listening, like, what should you do? I mean, if you haven't seen the movies that I've put out, Bitcoin is Generational Wealth and Legendary Treasure of Satoshi Nakamoto, and the shorter one, Bitcoin is Beautiful. And a guy named Bevan Waite's also turned a whole bunch of my essays into short videos on his Bit Intelligence channel. And if you like to read, I mean, my Medium has tons of stuff. The Swan blog has tons of stuff. Bitcoin Magazine has a few things. So you just need to Google my name and read some of the stuff. And if you are someone who likes my work, don't be shy about reaching out and letting me know what you like, or if you have questions about it. I've got time, right? And I'm in that process of learning. So I really do enjoy talking about ideas with people. And when people have questions about the ideas that I put out, I'm happy to take the role of teacher or writer explaining his writings. I do encourage people to not be strangers.
Hell yeah.
Oh yeah. It's always a pleasure being able to spend an hour or so talking to somebody like you and just hear your thoughts on anything. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah. I appreciate the time you guys spend with me too. Peace and love.
I'll be back.
We'll cut it. Thank you again for listening to the High Hash Rate podcast with Dan and Mike. If you want to learn more about the podcast and see what we're up to, you can find us at highhashrate.com. Or if you just want to speak to a couple of baked 80 IQ plebs, reach out to us at hello@highhashrate.com. Or you can reach out to us at the High Hash Rate handle on X. Later, everybody.
Holy Toledo!